Tonight, the Columbia Workshop presents Fulton Fish Market, the first work for radio by Kimball Flaccus, author of two books of poetry called Avalanche of April and The White Stranger. Kimball Flaccus is a member of the faculty at the College of the City of New York. He calls Fulton Fish Market a choric poem. The subject is an unlikely one. The piece has to do with the fish that would be found in the great Fulton Fish Market in New York City. Where the fish come from, how they breed, on what they prey, what preys on them, how they are caught, and who eats them. These are the materials of Mr. Flaccus' poem. Instead of having a professional poetry reader for the principal speaker, we have asked Bob Edge, Columbia's sports authority, who appears regularly in hunting and fishing talks on CBS, to carry the burden of the production. Fulton Fish Market, a choric poem by Kimball Flaccus.
Somebody said that sometime we ought to go down to the lower end of Manhattan, late at night, to the Fulton Fish Market.
What, to that place? Well, nobody ever goes there unless he has to. You will slip on slime and step on a rotten fish head and turn your ankle on cobblestones and be jostled by dirty people, and cats will follow you, hundreds of cats. And when you go home, your wife or your child or your father or mother or husband or sweetheart, singly or in pairs, or maybe most of them if they are awake, will wrinkle their noses and bar the door to you.
But somebody said it was important and thrilling and unforgettable, and a great thing to go down to the wharves at the foot of Fulton Street in the hours after midnight.
I heard you, lady. You have the right idea. Go down there and see for yourself sometime.
But fish are fish. Anybody knows what a fish acts like, looks like, tastes like. Anybody at all has seen a fish.
Perhaps my friends and I will tell you about it. My friends and I are aware how all the waters in and around this continent of ours bring wealth, excitement, beauty, and romance to the long wharves at the foot of Fulton Street.
What will we see if we go to the long wharves at the foot of Fulton Street here in Manhattan?
You will see the eddying life, the teeming life, the fat Germans from the delicatessens, the men with the blue eyes and the pink faces, and black-haired Irishmen from the chain stores, and lean young Jews and excitable Latin women.
What are they there for, all these various people, late at night when the rest of the city is sleeping?
They're there to haggle, to bargain, to buy fish, in small lots, in medium lots, and job lots. They're there to pinch and pry and to turn over, to heft a fish for its weight, examine its color. They're there to hesitate, to lift an eyebrow, to scratch stubble chins and to wrinkle foreheads. They're there to drop an eyelid in acquiescence, to flash a message to the auctioneer. They are there to buy fish for holidays, feast days, for religious days, and for every day in the week.
What else can we see?
You will see these buyers and the auctioneers and the truckmen yawning and the friendly cops and the hovering racketeers in the gray fedoras and patent leather shoes, still in the shadows, waiting and watching to reap a rich harvest from those who have bought baskets and must transport them. You will see the ships moored to the long wharves, silent and dark, with one light in the galley, or busy unloading, ablaze under the floodlights.
And what sounds will we hear late in the night, when our young friends are dancing and drinking in nightclubs? What is the music there at the Fulton Fish Market?
Down there you will not hear music to dance to, but you will hear the true voice of the city, the true voice of all American cities. Speech of many tongues, buying and selling. Speech of the drunken sailors and bronzed fishermen, the soft speech of the South, and the speech of Yankees. You will hear the speech of Swedes and the speech of Portuguese. You will hear the hiss of steam and the clatter of winches, the bark of command and the hoarse cries of the stevedores staggering under crates, balancing boxes, and the roar of ice pouring into the holds.
And what smells will there be?
Mixed with the dank smell of the East River, and the smell of coal smoke from the sleeping city, the salt smell of the sea will be keen in your nostrils, the smell of tarred rope and of spruce masts, the smell of oakum and oil and turpentine, the smell of fresh fish and decayed fish, the strong smell of fish that were soaked in brine and spread out on rocks near the Arctic Circle and dried in the cold wind and the pale sunlight.
Well, where do they come from, all these fish?
There are poems and songs and the tale of all the places the fish are gathered from to be brought here to the long wharves at the lower end of Manhattan.
From the rivers, ponds, and streams of America.
From the coastal waters of America.
From the bays,
marshes,
inlets,
and estuaries.
From the deep sea.
From the Grand Banks.
From the icy currents off Alaska and Labrador. Each day, by plane and in boxcar, in seiners and trawlers, in freighters and motorboats, the fish come to the foot of Fulton Street.
Frozen.
Or salted and dried.
Or barreled in brine.
Or laid in ice.
Or swimming in giant tanks. The flat fish and the lean-bodied racers.
The mountain fish. The delicate-boned leapers.
The sluggish sea-bottom grazers.
And the gilled half-fish. And the blind crustaceans. And the whirled univalves. And the hinged bivalves. And the frightful things. Fruit of submerged canyons.
The spidery octopus and the brittle starfish. The horseshoe crab that is not a crab. And the sea urchins, round and quilled for defense, the soft sea cucumbers. All these arrive in crates and barrels and baskets on the long wharves at the foot of Fulton Street. There are cod, haddock, hake, and halibut.
From the Grand Banks, from the fog-muffled waste, where dorymen leave their schooner wrapped in mist and utter a prayer of thanks when they find her again, where storms howl and hands freeze to the oars, and maybe during the long weeks at sea one of the men mutters and talks to himself and is brought back like a wild beast in irons, or maybe a quarrel flares and knives flash and an old sail is fashioned into a shroud. Maybe a liner looms out of the night, shearing the cotton murk is seen too late. In vain the frightened cries and the frantic bell. But there is hot coffee and rum and a song and the cheering thought of a bonus for all hands in the first craft to be loaded down to the gunwales as her skipper drives her home with topsails taut and lee rail under all the way to Gloucester.
There are swordfish.
Men from Nantucket, New Bedford, Martha's Vineyard leaned their weight on the iron rim of the crow's nest, perched in the cross trees high on the swaying foremast, shaded their eyes with their hands, and scanned their horizon, searching for whales as their vessel nosed at the ice floes, or lay becalmed in sight of palms and volcanoes. And the spout of a whale or the black hump in the distance brought a glad cry from the lookout, a cry from the deck, and boats were lowered away and oars were unshipped, and a lean harpooner poised in the prow of each, and the crews pulled with a will to the side of the spouter, sheer to the base of the cliff that was rolling and basking, knowing their lives depended on tempered steel and the hemp of the rope and the ribs of the boat and on courage and on quickness and skill and on strength and a measure of luck. But now the whales have grown scarce, and the sons and grandsons of men who harried them over the seven oceans sail in a smaller vessel in search of swordfish. Harpooner and lookout are one, and he stands on the bowsprit with steel in his hand and hemp in a barrel behind him and the quarry ahead, and his comrades placing trust in him. These two were hunters at heart and lovers of danger as they tracked the dorsal fin in the sea off Block Island.
When the sea strikes, it takes the young and the strong. 100 years ago, the women knew this as they took to themselves men of New Bedford, Nantucket. 100 years ago, they walked and waited and gazed at the gray Atlantic from fence rooftops. When the sea strikes, it takes the young and the strong, and leaves an emptiness, an ache in the heart. The women knew, and today the women know this.
There are mackerel.
These are the swift ones, silvery-sided, lithe and slim-bodied shoreline crowders. Wayward as wind, they ruffle the water, leap from the purse seine, streaked like green lightning. Swimmers in schools with ravenous shark teeth ranging below them, their nighttime passage is never a secret. Ravel sea surface with opal and phosphor.
There are kingfish and weakfish.
Each spring, these fish move north as the sea grows warmer along the Atlantic coast. They round Cape Hatteras, pass the Virginia beaches, visit the Chesapeake, leave Ocean City, Maryland behind them, probe the Delaware Delta, round Cape May, enter Barnegat Bay and are taken off Tuckerton. Past the New Jersey shore, filling harbor and inlet, they swim in a hungry horde, a silver horde. They skirt Long Island and come in late June in a swarm to their destination, Peconic Bay.
Who knows why the kingfish and weakfish swim thus far and no farther?
What force urges them?
What voice calls to them?
What thing beckons them? There are shad and striped bass.
Each spring these fish move to the mouths of rivers, forsake the pure salt of the fathomless sea for the dirty and brackish water that rolls from inland. They pass the floating scum and the apple crates, evade the racing keels and the sharp propellers, skirt the discharged drainage of towns and cities, and dodge the nets that are stretched on either bank.
And some escape.
And some become entangled.
And some go free.
And some are caught in the gill nets and brought to the wharves at the foot of Fulton Street.
Who knows why shad and striped bass leave the pure water, sea water, and enter harbor and river?
What force urges them?
What voice calls to them?
What thing beckons them?
The fish answer the age-old call that summons them, each in its way, each in its time and season.
Many are thwarted by the man-made hazards.
Many spend themselves on impassable barriers.
Many are caught in nets.
Many are poisoned.
But some survive to reach the spawning place and cast their million eggs upon the waters.
Swiftest, most graceful, and strongest of upriver swimmers, each spring the salmon gather in the Pacific. They band together and steel themselves for the journey. Then all at once, as though at a secret signal, they storm the Columbia River, ascend the rapids, balancing, leaping, stemming, and overriding the rock-girt rush with the powerful current they go. The sun sets, but the salmon pause not for rest. Some of their number fall in the spears of Indians, and others leaping are cunningly snared in mid-passage. The others that falter are battered and bruised on ledges. The sun rises, and still the salmon press forward. Their forms are black against foam and are bright in the whirlpools. The whole river from bank to bank is alive with them. And suddenly stopped in their course by a smooth wall of concrete, the old ones and wise ones churn at the base of the fall, then lead the way leaping up and around the fish ladders. The urge of their kind, the mysterious call, is so strong in them that if they were checked by the dam in this place, they would perish, and never again would salmon revisit this river. Fearlessly onward they press, up the Columbia hundreds of miles from their homes in the cold Pacific. They are all in a body now, but are soon dispersed as depth dwindles and the channel is subdivided. The bands break off, and the salmon travel along, and each survives, arrives at its native gravel bed in a brook that is cooled by the melting ice of glaciers.
How thrilling it sounds as you tell it. You cannot stop there. What becomes of them after they finish their journey?
Tell us, mister. What happens next?
Exhausted, they spawn, and they hatch their eggs and die. The urge of their kind accomplished, the cycle completed. And when the young have grown to the size of your finger, they give themselves to the current, are borne by the river alone and unguarded down on their perilous journey. Thousands are eaten by birds and by larger fish. Thousands are choked by the feathery dust of the sawmills. Thousands are swept into irrigation ditches to flounder in mud and lie baked in the sun under fruit trees. Thousands are swirled to the grinding gears of machines that turn the wheels of the turbines that light the cities. But hundreds of thousands safely reach the Pacific.
There are rainbow trout, grayling, and brook trout.
Trout are the sweet-fleshed fighters, the beautiful creatures flecked with green and red and black and gold. There are rainbow trout from Canada, courses of ice-cold torrents. They have played in the foam of rapids. There are grayling from Yellowstone Park, cruisers in spring-fed crystal that rise to the struggling fly and shatter the clear reflection of cloud and snow-capped peak. There are brook trout from eastern hills, from Poconos, Catskills, Berkshires, where they lie by day in the shadow of sunken rocks, or revisit the water-washed roots of the alders, or crouch in the sun-warm sand, their heads upstream in the riffles, watching for food to float to them. So wise and shy are the trout that the skillful man who would take them must creep like a ghost through the wild growth, flick fly after fly to his quarry before the fish bites at the barb and lashes the dimpling pool with rushes of plunging fury. Line whips, reel sings, rod bends before the tricked one is captured, creel cradled in ferny fragrance.
But
but thought they were in streams of meadow and mountain, and caught they were in streams of meadow and mountain, and brought they were from streams of meadow and mountain.
At the Fulton Fish Market, there are three kinds of romance. Romance of the fish themselves, romance of where they come from and how they are taken, romance of where they go when they leave the market. The eels are displayed in open barrels, and an Italian fruit vendor, smiling and showing very white teeth under a long black mustache, parts with a worn silver coin, rolls up his sleeve, reaches a hairy forearm into the barrel, and selects the eel of his choice. The one darling that appeals to him. In the gray light of dawn, he carries it home on the elevated, squirming and dripping in a burlap sack.
There is a giant surf clam.
Seasoned fighter against tidal currents, its heavy shell sand scrubbed to a bone white, for a long while it lay bedded beneath the breakers, resisting the surge and swell of the undertow, firm in the terrible suction of sand and sea.
But it was gathered,
and its fellows were gathered, and put into wet baskets and brought here to the long wharves at the foot of Fulton Street. There are quahogs.
Where do they go when they leave the market?
Quahogs and giant surf clams, twin brothers of storm and peace, go to a dark tenement. A sweaty Polish laborer in his shirt sleeves takes them out into the areaway, spreads an old newspaper on the concrete, and laying out the rock-like clams, blue, gray, and white together, cracks the thick shells with a hammer, and the coarse, tough meat goes into the making of rich stews and heavy, savory chowders that smell of garlic.
There are razor clams, soft-shell clams, and oysters.
And in other baskets, there are clams with shells that are thin and shaped like a razor and razor sharp. The Indians long ago used them for knives. There are clams with delicate oval shapes, the shells fragile and cunningly hinged together. When gulls seize them, when fishhawks dive for them, their fate is to be skyborne far inland and to be dropped on flat stones. And there are baskets containing oysters. When these were bound secure to the rocky bottom, they cautiously parted their shells, knobbed and black on the outside, smooth and lustrous within, and projected delicate cilia into the current. But they have been torn loose by steel prongs from their beds in estuary and inlet.
They have been gathered,
and their fellows gathered, and put into wet baskets and brought here, to the long wharves at the foot of Fulton Street.
The clams that escape fishhawk and seagull to be dug up by man, where do they go? And the oysters, what is their destination?
The soft-shell clams are put into big kettles and are killed with steam and then devoured by fat Irishmen with innocent faces amid cigar smoke and oratory at political banquets. The oysters that were not used in the kitchen of the hotel turn up some days later in a saloon on the south side of Chicago, where a bartender opens them and serves them to an unemployed youth standing at the bar, who probes them carefully with a grimy finger, hoping against hope to discover a pearl. But the youth, finding only a small crab, curses, swallows the oysters quickly, and frowning at the taste, gulps down his beer.
There are mussels, winkles, and whelks.
The mussels are sleek and dark and rounded. They cling together in clusters, grapes of the sea, although no wine is pressed from them. The shells, ground with peel and mortar, are brewed by the ancient Romans, produced a liquid into which the men of Rome dipped their standards, the hems of their white togas, and drew them forth again stained with imperial purple. And the Celts, on the cliffs of Britain, on the wide, flat, and tide-wet beaches of Gaul, gathered large spirals and small ones, the whelks and the winkles. They did not know that the creatures inhabiting these shells were wild and cruel as they themselves were. They did not know how sea snails embrace shellfish with a kiss of death, drilling round holes, inserting rough, avid tongues to consume the soft things in their own homes. The Celts knew only that these snails might be eaten. They knew that the large shells, when empty and placed to the ear, spoke to them in whispers, faint and far off, like sea sighing, bird crying, or the music of wind and branches. And they knew that when pierced, the shells became trumpets, and they ground the spiral shells and extracted from them a blue stain, which they rubbed on bodies and faces to frighten seaborne strangers.
music are three things contained in the spiral shells and the shells of mussels.
Food of warriors on the windswept beaches, wine dark color of war, color of empire, martial music out of the conch shell trumpet, sad music of death from the empty shell.
Where do they go, the mussels and winkles and whelks, when they leave the market?
They go to a restaurant in the Spanish Quarter, where a fat, swarthy man, his eyes fixed with melting affection on the hot dish before him, tucks a soiled napkin into his collar, delicately employing a gold toothpick that matches two of his front teeth. He sighs and extracts the white periwinkle from its tiny white shell, the blue and brown whelk from its tan shell, and the bright orange mussel from its double shell of dark purple.
There are sea urchins, starfish, the octopus.
Sea urchins and starfish are only designs for artists to draw. As for the octopus, I've seen it in newsreels. No one eats those things.
Some people eat them. Even now, a French-Canadian contractor in Worcester is sitting down to a meal of sea urchins, and a gourmet in Philadelphia is sampling a well-seasoned starfish. And in Newark, a muscular and not-too-intelligent Greek, kitchen knife in hand, is wrestling with a tired octopus.
There are crabs and lobsters.
I will tell you a tale as it happens and will forever happen. Two fishermen put out on a dory from Sea Isle City, New Jersey, to tend their nets fastened to stakes 3 miles offshore. They look twice at the gray sky, at the clouds forming low in the east, then look at each other, and with no words, dip oars and head out 3 miles toward Europe.
They must catch fish if they would have food,
and a man must have food if he would go on living.
The east darkens, but still they row on, panting for breath in the still air, and the long, lazy swells catch at their oars, and their arms are leaden, and the sea and the sky are the color of lead.
They must catch fish if they would have food,
and a man must have food if he would go on living.
The net is heavy as they draw it tighter, but it makes them happy to see the fish threshing and turning under the surface of the water. The dory is heavy as the men haul the net over the gunwale and stand knee-deep in fish. There is no wind at all now. Swells flatten into an ugly calm, and that is fortunate, because the dory is heavily laden.
They must catch fish if they would have food,
and a man must have food if he would go on living.
Then the storm breaks, and the sea foams as though a giant hand had stirred it to frenzy, and the fish that had been in the dory streak far under the surface in search of still water. But the bodies of the fishermen float for a long time, and at length, after 6 days, weighted by heavy boots and sodden clothing, they sink and roll grotesquely amid long streamers of kelp on the dim sea bottom. Each man has two arms, two legs. They are intact because no sharks have seen them. But now a strange thing happens. A blue shadow flicks sideways out of the ooze, is joined by another and by still another, and the shadows become claws that tear greedily at exposed faces.
A crab must find dead flesh if he would have food.
And a crab must have food in order to go on living.
Now a gigantic green lobster, cautiously waving antenna before him, shoots his 2-foot length out of a crevice, his tail spreading fanwise, his claws poised club-like, his eyes extended on stalks. He goes forward cleverly like a boxer with hunched shoulders, intent on attack, but wise to the chance of a counter-stroke.
A lobster must find dead flesh if he would have food.
And a lobster must have food in order to go on living.
And the dead men, turning somnolently, strike at the scavengers that are swarming over them. But their blows are stiff and ineffective, until a channel bass, grave and majestic, looms suddenly out of nowhere, peering straight ahead with myopic, moonstone eyes, opens wide, leathery jaws, grinds the crabs in its teeth, catches and devours the lobster.
And who knows whether or not the channel bass was caught and devoured in its turn?
The way of the sea is the way of eternal struggle.
The sea is not tranquil below the surface, but is alive with eyes and antenna of creatures waiting to pick the bones of the dead, to prey on their own kind or on other creatures.
The sea is alive with eyes, alive with claws, with traps and teeth waiting on wary ones. The way of the sea is the way of eternal struggle.
One does not despise fishermen. One admires them. For in the face of great danger, they kill fish so that they themselves may live. The industrious and agile crab is no less to be admired because it obeys the law of its nature and strips decayed flesh from dead bodies. And the shy lobster, king of crustaceans, with his craftily jointed, ingenious armor and his bone-crushing claws, is no less beautiful because he feeds on drowned men.
The sea scours, the sea devours, the sea cleanses. It has no time for the slow work of maggots.
The way of the sea is the way of eternal struggle.
If the sea could speak, it would tell a long story. The sea is deep and profound. The sea is mysterious. The sea is reluctant to give up secrets. In the sea, life began ages and ages ago. Out of the sea, life crawled. And you and I and all living creatures, unlike as we are and eerily transformed, are nevertheless related to the life which long ago crawled out of the sea.
In the sea, life began ages and ages ago. Out of the sea, life crawled.
The sea thrust up mountains. The sea cooled and carved continents. The sea subdued high places and washed over them. Before the land, there was sea. And the sea mastered the land and gave life to it, and the while keeping life of its own.
The sea is a vast place, a secret place. The sea is a cave of eternal darkness under a roof of torn blue fabric. The sea covers a multitude of creatures. The sea cloaks much courting, fighting, mating.
All the fish and the shellfish and the near fish we have described to you, all the harvest of ponds, rivers, streams of America, and of the coastal waters of America, which are gathered as food for man and brought to the market, live in the sea or spawn and die in the sea, or leave the sea and return to it, or are descended from fish that lived in the sea. Ages ago, fish rose with the heaving land, and long afterwards were merged with the sea, and were frozen into a green sleep by glaciers, and were carried hundreds of miles alive in the ice to increase the range of their kind. And some died, and others adapted themselves, and winding through chains of lakes and rivers, became the first continental explorers. It is believed that some fish, even today, cross America, swimming from ocean to ocean.
That is strange to hear, and difficult to believe.
Not after all the other incredible things we've heard tonight, and the beautiful pictures that words have made for us.
Look at the map in your imaginations, and trace the course of the fish across America. From the Pacific, they ascend the Columbia and follow the winding course of the Snake River and arrive in the Great Divide high in the Rockies at Two Ocean Pass in northwestern Wyoming, where a still pond in a mountain meadow is drained to the east by the tumbling Yellowstone, down which they flash to the brown Missouri River, thence to the rolling Mississippi, the Gulf of Mexico, and the blue Atlantic. And thus, ocean is linked with ocean and species exchanged, and waters replenished by nature as well as by man.
In the sea, life began ages and ages ago. Out of the sea, life crawled. Even today, the sea gives life to the land, the life that is speared and netted and dredged and gathered and brought to the wharves at the foot of Fulton Street, at the meeting of river with river, of rivers with harbor, of harbor with sea, at the lower end of Manhattan.
The Columbia Workshop has presented Fulton Fish Market, a choric poem by Kimball Flaccus. The narrator was Bob Edge, Columbia's sports authority. The orchestra was conducted by Victor Bay, and the entire production was directed by Earl McGill. Next week, the Columbia Workshop will present An Experiment in Sound and Symptoms of Being 35 by Ring Lardner. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.